Kadanoff. You all probably should call me Leo. The pronunciation of my last name is sort of up for grabs. My grandfather did it one way, and my father did it another way, and I do it a third way. Leo, simple and good. I'm going to be talking about the fundamentals of statistical physics. You all are working out of Jim Sethna's book. If you want to figure out where you want to look for a source where I prepared the lectures from, I have a book called Statistical Physics. If it hasn't been stolen, it's in your library. If it has been stolen, all the better. In any case, you can find the outline of almost all of my lectures there. I made heavy use this time around and last time around. I taught this a year ago also, of Wikipedia. I found it to be mostly respectably accurate. Here's an outline of this lecture. It's not exactly completely accurate because I changed the lecture over the course of the year and didn't change the outlines. I guess I should start out by telling you a little bit about myself and then finding out a little bit about you all. I'm a condensed matter physicist. I have worked on superconductivity, phase transitions, dynamical systems, fluid mechanics, and the history of physics. I strongly believe that the best way of continuing a career over a long term in physics is to get the breadth to work on many topics and then switch from topic to topic as one topic becomes less interesting and another topic becomes more interesting. I, in addition to doing theoretical physics, I'm a bit of a applied mathematician, and I teach and have been teaching at the University of Chicago for the last 30 years. Before that, I was at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, and before that, the University of Illinois in Urbana. I guess I should start out by finding out something about you all. Why don't I start out with continents? How many of you come from the North American continent? How many of you come from Asia? Africa? Europe? Good representation from every place. I won't do Antarctica. I assume I don't see any penguins. I won't do Antarctica. Every place else is well represented. How many of you were majors, physics majors in college? What other subjects? Mathematics? Chemistry? Material science? What else? Okay, I got them all. No, I don't. Yes, I do have them all. How many of you think of yourself as potential theoreticians? Theory? Experimenters? Good. Simulators? Okay. What computer languages do you all use? Use Fortran? No, Horace. C? C++? MATLAB? Mathematica? Basic? No. Yes? What have I left out? Python. You all using Python now? You're supposed to use it last year, and then they backed away from it. I'm not sure what's going to happen this year. I haven't done my liaison with the rest of the school tremendously well, as you can see from the fact that we have a little bit of physical difficulties in our setup. Okay, how many of you done research prior to coming here? In what areas of physics? In condensed matter physics? Particle physics? Atomic physics? What other areas, please? Okay, good. That's a good subject. What other areas? Good. Another good subject?
Optics.
Optics. Yes, sir. Good. We're going to have fun. We're going to cover many and many, many of the subjects that you have covered. How many of you have taken a previous course in thermodynamics? Statistical physics? Okay, there were more people who... How many of you not had a course in statistical physics? Not had? Okay. I will, in principle, start from the beginning. However, that doesn't mean that I won't go with the speed of light. And you all will have to work a little harder than your classmates in order to keep up. However, statistical physics is a part of physics. Like all other parts of physics, it fits together. The things you've learned in other parts of physics and mathematics and will all go very well with this subject. I might as well start with content. I wondered whether you could think of concepts which belong to statistical physics specifically and not to the quantum mechanics of a few particles at a time or the classical mechanics of a few particles at a time. I'll start out with my own, which is temperature. Temperature is not something that you can define for very well for one particle. It is something that describes lots and lots of particles and complicated situations. What other concepts can you think of that belongs specifically to statistical stuff?
Pressure.
Great. Okay. Good. What about currents? You hear about currents all the time. Currents are most often described in the context of lots of electrons moving down a wire or something like that, which involve statistical stuff. In fact, I have my own list. Let me see if my list will come up. Temperature, pressure, entropy, the first three that you all got. The way we describe electrodynamics in media is in terms of B, D, H, and E. One of those fields in each case represents the external field, external to the material, and the other includes the average field produced within the material. So these familiar concepts from electrodynamics are also statistical concepts. Phase, as in phase transition, phases of water, solid, liquid, gas, ice 9, all of those things are a specifically statistical concept and don't have anything at all, have very little to do with the quantum mechanics or the classical mechanics of few particles at a time. Phase transitions, okay, I said liquid gas, a solid plasma, a probability density matrix. The row that you saw in the last lecture is basically a statistical concept. It tells you the probability of finding a particle at a point X. There, I'm going to pick up as much as I can things from your other lecture or lectures and use them in the context of statistical physics in order to make sure that I make the point that statistical physics and all the physics are a unity. Correlations are something that we describe using statistical concepts. Entanglement, which you guys from fundamentals of quantum stuff know about. Entanglement is a specifically statistical concept, as is chaos, as is order, butterfly effect, reaction rate, chemical potential. All of these relatively familiar concepts are also in their nature statistical. Sorry to reach over you. Lots of very interesting stuff that goes on in the world is described in statistical terms. One of the great advances of physics in the last several decades is the Bekenstein-Hawking theory of radiation from black holes and the entropy of black holes. This is all describes black holes in statistical terms. Many of you are going to be interested, not all of you, but many of you are going to be interested in astrophysics, in fundamentals of quantum theory, and that will come up for you. The universe is filled with black body radiation at a temperature of 3 degrees, left over from the Big Bang. Statistical concepts. The radiation is described in statistical terms. Bell's theorem is a theorem which describes classical mechanics in probabilistic terms. Bell's theorem is about a part of classical mechanics which does not agree with quantum mechanics. Of course, statistical stuff is used to describe the complexity that arises in the universe. If you want to calculate or think about or do something about the probabilities of hearing from civilizations elsewhere in the universe, you're going to have to think about the probabilities and the civilizations and all of that in statistical terms. Markets are, economic markets are based on the statistics of lots of actors acting partially independently of one another. If you want to understand why the market economy works or fails to work, you will have to understand statistical stuff. You may notice that as time gets on, you get older. This is part of an irreversibility phenomenon, which is of direct interest to each and every one of us. We describe it in terms of the lack of time reversal invariance in our lives, even though we know that the laws of both classical and quantum mechanics show a substantial amount of time reversal invariance. One of the things you should perhaps worry about, although I wouldn't sit up nights thinking about it, it's an unlikely thing, is that there will be a major Earth-asteroid collision. We know it's unlikely because we've calculated probabilities. You'll have to wait 100,000 years in order to see one, sort of on the average, I think, according to the best present estimates. You should not try to hold your breath for 100,000 years. Quantum mechanics is expressed in terms of probabilistic interpretations, probability theory is crucial for that. There are those who hold, very wise and deep physicists, who hold that our universe is unlikely. That is, that it must have been some wonderful accident or maybe a wonderful choice that produced the universe that we now see. This is an interesting question, and I don't know quite what to do with it. Okay, so the next lecture, we're going to start, well, actually it's going to start this probably this time, but the next major portion of the course, we'll start with probabilities. To show what an unlikely subject this is, I give you this picture, which was constructed after the style of an artist by the name of Escher. You may notice that this probability this representation of probabilities is unlikely in its own way. In fact, quite impossible. Quite impossible. Look at it. In that great work of science, the Alice in Wonderland, Alice was advised to believe three impossible things before breakfast each day, presumably to help her grow as a scientist and mathematician. Well, I just gave you one of them you should believe in. Okay, we're going to start out working with probabilities. I'm going to tell you the fundamentals of probabilities. Then I'm going to put things on a lattice, just as you got things on a lattice in the last lecture. I'm going to start working with I won't do phonons. I will do what are called Ising variables. I'll put them on a lattice and then give you the world's most superficial description of what is called the renormalization group, which is a piece of 21st century physics. But since much of the course is 19th and early 20th century, it's good to have some stuff which is fairly recent. Statistical mechanics is about what happens. Statistical mechanics in its simplest form is what happens to systems in statistical equilibrium. What happens when you let systems settle down? However, as part of the subject, we want to know how do we get to statistical equilibrium. And to do that, we will talk about random walks and diffusion. You will, at this stage, begin to deal with my thinking as an applied mathematician, because I'm going to tell you all about partial differential equations of various kinds. And that's one of my subfields. Then I'm going to talk to you about how particle collisions, like this collision here, produces statistical equilibrium. This will be probably the oldest portion of the course. It goes back to the work of Boltzmann in the 1870s. However, it is also probably the most sophisticated part of this course. People have been doing interesting and exciting mathematical and physical science for millennia, and Boltzmann's work is not less interesting than what we do today. That will be part five of the course. Part six may not happen. Only two of you haven't had a course of this kind before. That means that there are probably only two of you that don't know about the probabilistic differences between bosons and fermions and how they differ from classical particles. If I run short of time, I won't talk about this part of the course. I won't talk about how the bosons and fermions behave. It is in the standard books, including Sethna's and mine. Instead, I will progress to a subject which has been one of my own research subjects. That is the subject of phase transitions. I'm going to start out by talking to you about classical, that is, old work on phase transitions involving what are called mean fields. I'm going to talk about the mean field theory of phase transitions. I will start out by pointing out to you something that I can point out on this picture. The phases of matter, different phases, are indeed very different. The ice in the iceberg behaves differently from the water vapor in the air, behaves differently from the liquid water in the ocean. The ice, when it gets to solidify, can do beautiful, exciting things that liquid water cannot do. There are qualitative and exciting changes between the different states of matter and nature, and we will talk about how they arise. Then we come to the theories which describe these phase transitions. I'm going to be talking about universality and scale invariance and renormalization. And these are all theoretical words that underlie much of the important stuff in statistical physics, in solid state physics, in condensed matter physics, plasma physics, and in particle physics, astrophysics also. Last but not least, something that didn't exist in the course last year, so isn't probably in fully in, well, maybe in your notes, probably a little sloppier than I had in the rest of the notes since I've only been over it once, is we're going to talk about what is called conformal symmetry. That is the kind of symmetry that is shown near phase transitions. It's a rich and beautiful mathematical symmetry, and you will pick up a course on conformal invariance after this one, immediately after this one. I will introduce it by telling you a little bit about how conformal symmetry arises in statistical physics. I'm ready to start, but maybe I should ask, I'm perfectly happy to get questions from you all anytime, but there's a natural pausing point here, so I should ask whether questions or comments or things that you want to hear more about. Okay. I start out between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics. What is called the Ising system depends on a variable called sigma z, which takes on two values, plus or minus one. It is quantized. It comes from quantum mechanics. It is, in fact, the z component of the spin of, say, an electron or any other spin one-half particle. We're going to treat it classically because we're not going to talk for much of this course about sigma x and sigma y, which have anti-commutation relations with sigma z. They anti-commute with sigma z. Therefore, we will be treating it as a classical variable. Sigma z will commute with everything. Another piece of contact with the previous lecture is the statement that the description of a physical system is given by stating it's Hamiltonian. It's not only true for theorists, it's true for experimentalists as well, but whenever you're asked what is the system you're dealing with, one kind of answer that you can give is to describe the Hamiltonian, or almost equivalently the Lagrangian, which describes the system. Here we're going to give this the Hamiltonian, which describes the energy of a spin in a magnetic field. The magnetic field is going to be in the z direction. And we have a Hamiltonian, which is H, called H, and is the magnetic moment, mu, on the particle, times the magnetic field in the z direction, times the spin in that z direction with a minus sign. Statistical mechanics is defined by a probability. Okay, for the people who organize things, I'm not going to work this way for the next lecture. The next lecture, I want to have my screen in front of me. That means that I have to have a place to work from, and that place to work from ideally should be higher than the desk, and the cable should run to it. It's a wonderful thing that we have in size outgrown the room. That's great, but I'm not going to, this part on my neck to go like that all the time. To see what I have prepared for you all. Okay. The statistical mechanics is defined by a probability density. The probability density always takes the form that is a constant here called 1 over z, times an exponential function of the Hamiltonian divided by a Boltzmann constant times the temperature. The Boltzmann constant is just a number, and the temperature describes how thoroughly the system seeks out low energy states. In this case, the probability of seeing a value of sigma equal to either plus 1 or minus 1, both cases are here, are this 1 over z times an exponential of the Bohr magnetron times the magnetic field times the spin value divided by kT. We'll use an abbreviation, H, for this combination of stuff, multiplying sigma. So H is just a number, and the probability density is 1 over z times the exponential of H times sigma. Now, every probability has the property that it is normalized. That means that the sum over all possibilities of the probability is equal to 1. And that gives you directly, by summing this over all possibilities, over sigma is plus or minus 1, that gives you z is going to be equal. I'll do that on the blackboard. I'm going to do it slow now. I'm going to do it fast a zillion times in this course, but once for slow is perfectly appropriate. Sigma has values plus or minus 1. The sum over all possibilities of a probability is equal to 1. So 1 is 1 over z times e to the h, that's one possibility, plus e to the minus h, that's the other possibility. So z is twice the hyperbolic cosine of h. And I sure hope that's what it says on the slide, because that's the right answer. And then we want to calculate, the next thing we want to do is calculate, there's only one thing really that we can calculate, which is the average of the spin. Again, I will show this to you at zero speed. And later on, perhaps, we'll see it happen faster. We sum over both possibilities. The probability of having this thing come out, called rho, times the value of the thing when it comes out. This is the way you calculate an average, and an average is represented by these angular brackets. Rho is 1 over z times e to the h. Sigma is plus 1, so we multiply this by plus 1. We have a 1 there. We have the other possibility, e to the minus h times minus 1. And the answer is twice a cosh on the bottom and twice a cinch on top. And that's the answer is the hyperbolic tangent of h, tanha of h, which is cosh h over cinch h over cosh h. This is statistical mechanics in a nutshell. This is all we do in statistical mechanics with slightly more complicated Hamiltonians and slightly more complicated stuff. And we then use it in order to gain a understanding of various exciting things that happen in the universe, including the phase transitions and other things which at first sight seem hard to understand. Now, I did this calculation one way. I calculated directly the average of sigma There's another way of doing the same calculation, and that other way of doing the same calculation involves taking the z, which is called the partition function, and is as given by here, a hyperbolic cosine of this dimensionless version of the magnetic field. You calculate the derivative of the logarithm of the partition function with respect to a parameter in the Hamiltonian. You're actually very used to doing this if you've taken a thermodynamics course. In thermodynamics, statistical mechanics will teach you, or I will teach you, that z is e to the minus the free energy divided by kt. And you're absolutely used to taking the derivatives of free energy with respect to parameters like h. The derivative of the free energy with respect to h is directly proportional to the magnetization. And the magnetization itself in this simple case is directly proportional to the average value of sigma. But let's do the calculation. Let's work it out and see what happens. The derivative of the logarithm of z with respect to h is the sum over sigma exponential of h sigma divided by z. This is exactly the calculation on this blackboard. It is exactly the calculation of the average magnetization. It is exactly the value, has the value of the hyperbolic tangent of h. We therefore see that by calculating this derivative with respect to a parameter in the Hamiltonian, we get an average value of the thing that that parameter multiplies. That's the general way in which we do calculations in statistical mechanics. So there I showed you sort of the basic way in which it's done. Here's the way in which it's really done. Theorists calculate, experimentalists measure, simulators find out the value of things like the free energy, and then differentiate with respect to parameters. The second derivative with respect to h is not hard either. Let me do it on the blackboard. Second derivative of the logarithm of the partition function with respect to h. Well, the first derivative is given by the average magnetization, that's what it says up there, and that is the sum over sigma times e to the beta h divided by the sum over some other variable giving us the partition function of e to the sigma h e to the mu h. This is the definition of the average value of sigma, which is the derivative, which is this first derivative of the logarithm of z with respect to h. Now we have to do the second derivative. The second derivative can either act there or can act there. You then get two terms, and I'm going to ask you to work out those two terms for yourself. Those two terms give you, when you get done, the average value of sigma minus the average of sigma squared. And that, the average, you work out this square, and you get 1 minus the average of sigma squared, or 1 minus tan h squared. You can directly calculate that the second derivative of cosh is 1 minus the hyperbolic tangent squared. The thing I want to convey to you is not the details of this second calculation. It's too hard for me to do, in fact, given the split between the blackboard and the screen. Instead, what I want to say is that all derivatives of the logarithm of the partition function are thermodynamic functions of some kind. As I'll say below, we expect simple behavior from the logarithm of z, but not directly from differentiating z itself. We get, in particular, in general, the derivative of the logarithm of z is going to be proportional to the magnetization if we differentiate with respect to the magnetic field. If we differentiate the logarithm of z with respect to temperature, we get things that depend on the average energy, and so forth. This ends the survey. This tells you what we're going to be doing in the statistical mechanics course, and I'm going to then start out with the contents of the course as soon as I listen to you and find out whether there are any questions. Okay, next piece is called Basics of Statistical Physics. Here is a rough outline of that piece, and I'm going to go on then to go through the calculation. I start by doing the same calculation as I just did, but in a slightly more general fashion. Nope, that's not right. I'm sorry. I start by talking about frequencies and probabilities. Imagine that we have mutually exclusive events. Either event 1 happens, or event 2 happens, or event 3 happens. Either I'm in my 40s, or my 50s, or my 60s, or my 70s. These are mutually exclusive events at a given time. And the question is, what is the probability? What is the likelihood of that? If I take a population, I can ask, what are the number of people in these different decades? I will call the number of people that satisfy the condition N alpha. And the number of people under study are the sum over alpha and alpha. And alpha then represents the number of times a given event shows up. This is where we start in dealing with probabilities. We imagine very large n and very large values of n alpha. And we think of situations, as for example, with age distributions in populations, we think of situations in which the result that you get doesn't change much when you go to larger and larger populations. And what you mean by the result is things like rho alpha, the probability of seeing a value alpha, which is the ratio of n alpha over n. Since the total probability is n, the sum over all alpha of rho alpha is equal to 1. This is one of the fundamental requirements on probabilities. The other fundamental requirement on probabilities is that they are positive. They are not negative numbers. They can be 0. We deal often with relative probabilities. The relative chance that alpha will turn up. that is, in fact, this e to the h sigma is a relative probability. It gives the relative chance that sigma will have the value plus 1 or the relative chance that will have the value minus 1. To go from a relative probability, r sub alpha, to an honest probability, rho sub alpha, you divide by z, which is the sum over alpha r alpha, and you get the probability as r alpha divided by z. You insist that the probability satisfy the condition that the normalization condition that it's summed to unity. For example, if I have an ordinary crap game with an ordinary set of dice which have 6 sides, I then have a relative probability, which is independent, if the dice are fair, of which die, which side of the die I'm looking at. I have a relative probability that the various sides of the die will come up, which is constant. It is conventional to say that r sub alpha is 1. I could have said r alpha was 17 and gotten just about something just about as good. To get the normalization condition, I sum r alpha over all values of alpha, and I get z is equal to 6. So the probability of any given side of the die coming up is 1/6. Okay, what am I doing wrong here? Okay. Imagine that we have two different kinds of events. Alpha and beta label the two different kinds of events. On the screen, it says roughly something like, imagine that we have a temperature on one day and the probability that it will snow a year later. Those two things are probably quite, may or may not be independent of one another. If it's not a year later but the next day, those two things are probably very closely related to one another. But we could talk about the probability that you have the two outcomes, rain and snow, and the probability that you have the different values of the temperature. These are quite different things. However, you could also talk about the joint probability, the probability that it will be both true that it will rain and that the temperature will be such and such. That is indicated by giving the two subscripts, alpha and beta. The sum over all alpha and beta of rho alpha beta is equal to 1. That's just our definition of the normalization of a probability. Everything up until now in part 2 is probably familiar to 90% of you. Just reminding you about things that you know, except perhaps for the relative probability stuff, which goes more with statistical mechanics than freshman courses in probability. Now comes something which may be new to some of you. Rho alpha slash, I don't know what you call this, up and slash beta is the probability that event alpha will occur if we know already that event beta has occurred. This is called a conditional probability. Rho alpha slash beta is equal to rho alpha beta divided by the probability that beta will show up. Something will happen means that the sum over alpha of rho alpha slash beta is equal to 1. And of course, this conditional probability also satisfies the condition that it is positive. Okay. This is all mathematics. and has, as stated, has, no, I have one more slide of mathematics, sorry. Now I'm going to talk about independent events. Sometimes the two events, alpha and beta, are independent of one another. I have to define what that means, but you sort of know what it means. The weather, the probability of snow tomorrow depends to a large extent on the temperature today. These are not independent of one another. However, the probability of snow a year from now is going to be largely independent of the temperature today. And that independence is expressed mathematically by the statement that the probability of alpha and beta being true, rho alpha sub beta, is the probability of alpha being true times the probability that beta is true. Thus, the probabilities, the independence is the statement that the joint probability factorizes into a product of pieces referring to the individual events, or it is a statement that the number of times alpha and beta comes out also factorizes in exactly the same fashion. Now, this has something to do with statistical mechanics. And I should be careful to tell you about what it has to do with statistical mechanics. This form, rho of whatever the variable is e to the minus beta Hamiltonian of that variable divided by z. That's the general form of statistical mechanics. Beta is 1 over the Boltzmann constant times temperature. Sometimes I'll put in the b for the Boltzmann constant, sometimes I won't. Sometimes I'll put in the k, and sometimes I won't. This is our general definition of statistical mechanics. What does that have to do with what's on this slide? Well, the Hamiltonian for a system of which contains two parts which are independent of one another. That is the Hamiltonian for an atom right here and the behavior of a black hole at the center of the galaxy. If these are independent of one another, we write this as the sum of terms which are simply the sum of terms which refer to the two pieces. That makes this into a product of terms which refer to the two pieces. That makes the probability have the product form. The sum form of the Hamiltonian translates into the product form for the probability, and that's the right answer. So you have a whole series of events that are statistically independent of one another. The joint probabilities that they will turn out all to be true is, of course, just a product. And if the Hamiltonian is a sum of Hamiltonia for a zillion different atoms, and those atoms behave independently of one another, then this is just a sum of a zillion terms, and that makes the probability into a product of a zillion terms. This has the right structure. And
excuse me.
Yes, please. I'm sorry, thank you.
Sorry, does that mean that the partition function also factorizes?
Yes, quite so. That is, it's going to be on the next slide, but yes, the partition function also factorizes. The relative probabilities factorize, the Z factorizes, and that's the fundamental representation of independence in at least this form of statistical mechanics. Okay, we're continuing here with the description in mathematical terms of probabilities. A simple outcome can happen only one way. If I'm throwing two dice and I get out the value 2 for the sum of the two dice, I know what's happening. It only occurs in one way. Each die has turned out with a 1. There's no 0 on dice. A complex outcome can happen several different ways. For example, a 7 can be a 4 on one die and a 3 on the other, or 5 and 2, or we can interchange what happens, and the two dice can interchange. One should calculate the probabilities of complex outcomes as the sums of probabilities of the individual outcomes. And if the simple outcomes are equally likely, the probability of complex outcomes is the sum over the simple outcomes times the probability of the simple outcome. There's a lot of counting in statistical mechanics. The number of ways something can happen is usually denoted by the symbol W. Entropy is given by the equation entropy is Boltzmann's constant times the logarithm of W. K here is Boltzmann's constant, that sense. This is on Boltzmann's tombstone. He, the inventor of statistical mechanics, thought that this was his finest contribution to the world, and in many ways it is. The concept of entropy is much broader than that of statistical mechanics in general. And the logarithm of a probability is also much broader. Probability distributions. We've talked about discrete events. Discrete means in this context that you number them with an integer. However, we often have continuous things. For example, the probability that a particle would appear with a coordinate x in quantum mechanics is psi of x magnitude squared. That's called the probability density, psi of x magnitude squared. A probability that will appear between x and x plus dx is psi of x magnitude squared times dx. Psi of x squared is called the probability density. This thing is a honest-to-goodness probability. It's infinitesimal. The normalization condition on probability densities is that the integral, minus infinity to infinity of the probability of x dx is equal to 1. For example, in classical statistical mechanics, you probably all have seen the formula for the probability that the momentum, one component of momentum, will come out to have the value p. The probability density for this is given by a normalization factor in front times an exponential of the kinetic energy p squared over 2m. Divided by kT. Therefore, Boltzmann's basic formula, in which we have the probability being given by an exponential of minus the Hamiltonian, applies equally well to probabilities and probability densities. This particular form of probability is called the Gaussian probability distribution. Now I'm going to come back and say what I said before about what happens when we have many different terms in the Hamiltonian, or we have many different events happening independently of one another. Imagine a material in which we have many atoms, each of which has its own spin. system has a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of the Hamiltonia of the different atoms. H is the sum over all the guys of this constant proportional to the magnetic field times the Z component of the spin of the alpha guy. The reason I've, of course, that I dropped in the earlier slides the subscript Z for the Z component of spin is that I wanted to put in a subscript alpha describing which particle it is. The probability distribution is proportional to e to the minus beta, H, beta being 1 over kT, H being the Hamiltonian. That's 1 over Z times a product of individual terms that belong to the individual atoms. This Hamiltonian is a sum. The result is a product. Here comes the result for the partition function. The partition function is calculated by the condition, once more, that the probability has the total probability summed over all the spins is going to be equal to 1. And that makes Z, which is the sum over all possibilities of this guy, a product of n identical terms, each one of which is what we calculated before, twice the hyperbolic cosine, and that means small z to the n. Generally, I will use a notation in which capital Z refers to lots and lots of individual particles, small z to one particle at a time. The entire probability, then, is a product over individual things of the probabilities of the individual events. This says, once again, what I said before, that the sum in a Hamiltonian is going to be a product in a probability distribution, a product in a partition function, and a product in a relative probability. Notice this beautiful structure. The beautiful structure is that exactly the same form, e to the minus beta h, which holds for one atom, holds for many. All of the best laws of physics have the result that is a structural invariance. As you change what you're looking at, you get basically the same structure out again. For example, if I talk about gravity, I talk about tiny little particles. They each exert a force, which is g times m divided by r squared. If I have many, many, many such particles, exactly the same formula holds, except that the masses involved are the masses of the individual particles. The same sort of thing occurs in electrodynamics. A wave function is the same basic kind of thing and obeys the Schrodinger equation of the basically the same way kind for one particle or many. The structure of space and time have a similar structural invariance. Mao Zedong is reputed to have said that that a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. It is certainly true that different measures of distance have the same basic qualities. And this, then, is called a scale invariance and is an important property of our understanding of space and time. Indeed, much of this course, much of your entire course here, is about the structure of space and time. It is also about the structure of the mathematical structure of the theories we use to understand space and time. And the mathematical structure, which is most important for probabilities, is what is called a Gaussian probability distribution. A probability distribution for x given in a Gaussian form is proportional e to the minus x squared plus a constant times x plus another constant. Or has the structure e to the minus x squared times a constant conventionally divided by 2 with this normalization factor. 1 over beta is called the variance of this distribution. The sum of two statistically independent Gaussian variables is another Gaussian variable. Notice the structural invariance. That structural invariance is an important property of the Gaussian distribution. One important theorem involving Gaussian variables is a very useful statistical theorem. If we have lots and lots and lots of Gaussian variables, and each one has a finite, that is not infinite, variance, then the sum of a very large number of if we have lots and lots and lots of variables, not necessarily Gaussian, and they have each of them has a finite, not infinite variance, then the sum of the large number of variables, whether or not they are Gaussian, is a Gaussian variable. We will make use in this course of the statement that the sum over lots of spin variables, this sum, if n is large, is a Gaussian variable, even if sigma takes on the values plus or minus 1, so the individual variables are not Gaussian at all. Yes, please.
What is the variance for non-Gaussian variables?
Sorry, excuse me. Thank you. The variance, and I'm not sure about factors of two, to be frank with you, the variance is the mean square fluctuation. It tells you how much the variable fluctuates. In mathematical terms, if the variable is x, it is x minus the average of x squared and averaged. Thank you for asking. You all will discover that from time to time I screw up. My not defining variance, for example, is a clear screw up. If you catch me with my screw ups, I likely not to confuse you all. And if you don't catch me, I'm likely to confuse you. So I thank you very much for catching me, and look forward to being caught many times, or the appropriate many times. It's going to happen. Okay. Continue with the mathematics. If we have an integral of the form of an exponential of some constant times x squared plus another constant times x plus a third constant, if these things are real numbers, this integral is really rather simple to calculate, and this integral is very, very useful in all parts of theoretical physics. It is usually converted into what is called a canonical form. That canonical form, for statistical purposes, if we have a probability of a variable x having the value small x, then the canonical way of writing it involves exactly what I said before, x minus the average of x. If it's Gaussian, it's a form x minus the average of x squared times some constant, and that's beta over 2. And then you have a normalization factor, which is beta over 2 pi squared. This Gaussian form is produced from this kind of thing by completing the square, by, in fact, taking this object and constructing a square out of it as shown here. And you can then get this, what is called canonical form, this usual form for the probability distribution. The Gaussian probability distribution has, as you can calculate by doing an integral, the very important result that if we have a Gaussian probability distribution for a random variable x, the average of the exponential of iq dot x is then going to be equal to the exponential of the average times q squared divided by 2 beta, an exponential minus q squared over 2 beta. Mm-hmm. Notice how the beta appears in the numerator here and the denominator there. That's a structurally important feature. Well, I told you that Gaussian distributions are important in classical mechanics. Let's see how much we have more here. I'm going to finish with the result that if we have a classical particle, the Boltzmann distribution for that classical particle gives the probability that you will have probability distribution in P and R is the exponential of e to the minus beta h. And if h is the Hamiltonian is proportional to p squared over 2m plus u, then this probability is proportional to an exponential of p squared over 2m. It is often chosen that u, we put particles inside of a box, and that u is infinite outside the box and zero inside. In that case, we can easily calculate the integral, which gives the normalization of the probability distribution. The integral over R gives you the volume of the box. The integral over P gives you the e to the minus beta P squared over 2m. And if this P squared is in three-dimensional space, we get three factors of 2 pi m over beta to the 1/2. Differentiate this partition function with respect to beta, and we find from differentiating that average energy is 3/2 kT. Each, the classical result is that each term in the Hamiltonian, which is of the form of a square, gives you a factor of kT over 2 summed in the average energy. So if we have, as given in your last lecture, n oscillators, each of which has a momentum and a coordinate, there are nkt as the average energy of such a system when it's at temperature T. I will come back from here. This is the end of our review. This is supposed to be, was supposed to be, a review of the mathematics and of the physics that one might have gotten in your previous statistical mechanics course. There's practically nothing in this review which probably should have been new to most of you. So look at it carefully, make sure you understand it. The people for whom this is new stuff should look at it even more carefully and see what they can understand, and look at the appropriate part of Sethna out of my book to see where they can gain additional understanding. Next time, we do all of this on lattices, and we come to renormalization, which will be a new topic for many of you. Oh, that's a good thing for me to find out. How many of you have seen renormalization in a previous course? Many of you will find it to be new. How many of you have seen it in real space in the previous course? There are two ways of doing renormalization. There's momentum space and real space. How many have seen it in real space? How many have seen it in momentum space? We'll do it the way you've seen it before in the in real space. Other courses in this program here at Perimeter will do it in momentum space. For those of you who have seen renormalization before, that's a minority. I apologize for the next lecture not being entirely new. I hope to get some new subjects into that lecture. And by the time we get done, I expect we will have some new subjects for everyone. How many people here have, in a math or physics course, seen conformal invariants? One, two, two and three. Okay, this is not the new topic for you. How many have seen the Boltzmann equation? Bless you all, you're well educated. Education works best on people who know things and are clever to begin with. I am most impressed by the high level of your knowledge. I hope to explain things with such clarity that your knowledge will increase, even if you have some previous acquaintance with the subject. Next time we go from these mathematical things on to physical stuff, and we start talking about the physics of statistical mechanics and of renormalization. Questions? Comments? If not, let's break.
Like to set up. You want, would you like that to go with